If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. Taking no prisoners, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right. I've quoted many times the Nazi historian, the UCLA emeritus professor historian, Saul Freelander, Holocaust survivor, who described the Nazi ideology and the governance as using the bureaucracy to enforce magical beliefs. And I think that really describes today's green agenda. It's actually beyond the green agenda. It also describes critical race theory, certainly transgenderism, a magical belief that a man or woman could just change genders and then compete in other sports and you can't call. Anyway, it truly is a time of magical beliefs, and it's a time of the bureaucracy trying to enforce it. To a point, we have Joe Biden's Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, being asked by the mainstream corporate media about the EVs and how they're just not quite working out like they thought they would and what the U.S. is going to do. But Janet Yellen is steeped in magical beliefs. Clip one.
This administration has placed a lot of emphasis on domestic production of electric vehicles, of batteries, but demand for electric cars is falling, or is falling off rather. And it does seem like this is the sort of product that may require sort of constant subsidies to prop up demand. You've talked a little bit about this, but let me push you somewhat to say, I mean, has this been a wrong bet by you and the president?
I think we're going to see a growing and thriving electric vehicle industry in the United States. We're already seeing that. I think the prospect for sales of EVs, especially as the charging network is built out nationally and the adjustments take place in the supply chain that enable car manufacturers to qualify for the there's a $7,500 tax incentive that's available for purchasers of these cars. We've issued notices of proposed rulemaking on how to qualify. It does require substantial shifts in the supply chain in particular, but we're seeing that occur. And electric battery production in the United States is just booming. I've been in Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, other places to see huge build out of electric batteries for EVs. And I think we're going to see swelling demand in the years ahead, and the incentives are all there.
Swelling demand. How does this not qualify perfectly for using the bureaucracy to enforce magical beliefs like past totalitarian regimes? She's talking about there's a $7,500 credit. And oh yeah, there's some supply chain issues that have to be dealt with, but we've got this incentive and we've got this mandate and we got these subsidies. And I toured a battery plant and it looked like there was a lot of batteries. So it's all just happening. And that's our plan. There's going to be swelling demand because we put it on paper. We're bureaucrats. We haven't been elected, but we put it on paper and you know, the plan is there. The plan is there. I see it on paper. It's going to happen. Who cares about frickin' reality? The plan's on paper. This is magical. The battery plant she's talking about can't even stay, go bankrupt before they can even produce the battery-powered cars. You're having the major freight industries, FedEx and others, can't even get the trucks because of supply chain because no one can make the batteries or supply the batteries. The whole thing is a cock-up from beginning to end. The government came in like East Germany with the Trabant and said, you must have these cars, only these cars, EVs. We're going to ban the competition. These cars are so wonderful and there's such demand that we're going to ban anyone from buying anything but what we think is so wonderful with the swelling demand. They can't get a pee urination trickle of demand, let alone a swelling demand. All right, we shouldn't talk about that body part. We're using a lot of weird language here. It's nuts. Okay, she is the epitome of using the bureaucracy to enforce magical beliefs. It's nuts. I feel bad for her. That is a clueless old woman who probably should not be in that position. I don't know what she was like when she was younger, but I can't imagine. I'm not sensing a lot of brain power coming out of Janet Yellen. Yeah, does that make me a chauvinist because I'm attacking the intellect of a woman? I don't know, but she is frighteningly comes across as a simpleton, okay? A serious simpleton on economics, on government policy, on EVs, and her areas of expertise, okay? I said it. All right, let's move on and talk about other things. Sorry, okay. I thought this was interesting. This is some people are calling her the new Greta. This is a young climate activist named Clover Hogan. What a great name, Clover. I never met anyone by the name of Clover. Never heard of that name before, but I like it. I've heard of Grover for a man, but this is a female. She's a 24-year-old climate activist, founding executive director of, it's like a bunch of symbols. I don't know why people do this. Force of Nature is what she's founded. It's empowering young people to turn climate anxiety into action and tackle the world's problem. Let's turn all that doomsaying bullshit that's been filled in our heads by the ruling class billionaires since we were in kindergarten, and let's change the world the way the billionaires want us to change it, and the way the World Economic Forum and the UN and all that, we want to do their bidding, but we're not going to be self-aware and realize it. We're going to act like we're against the man, even though the man has propagandized you since you were an infant, you effing. All right, sorry. Clover Hogan, here she is talking about the most insidious form of climate denial is no longer, it's not happening. In other words, people who deny climate change aren't there anymore. I guess she doesn't know about me. I'm still here. I'm a dinosaur, but I'm still here. All right, play. This is Clover Hogan, a force of nature, turning climate anxiety into action. Clip two.
When I first learned about the climate crisis, I was overwhelmed by feelings of grief and anger and frustration, powerlessness. But I think more than anything else, I remember feeling really confused. I couldn't understand how I hadn't learned about the climate crisis in school, why I hadn't seen it on the TV when my parents watched the news, you know, why we didn't talk about it at the dinner table. And so I became obsessed with this idea of, you know, why is it that the adults in my life are so good at sleepwalking, even when all of the evidence, all of the science shows that we're hurtling toward this cliff of climate and ecological collapse? What I've learned in the years since is that the most insidious form of climate denial is not, it's just not happening. Because actually that is now the minority. It is the belief that incremental solutions that fail to go to the root of the crisis will genuinely address the problem.
Sorry, I'm one of those deniers sleepwalking through her life. Must get sleep, need cheese sandwich. She is saying that, first of all, climate denial is all, what does that mean? Like, the evidence is so overwhelming, there's no climate denial. What is she talking about? Even the UN admits hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, wildfires, droughts, no trend on 30, 50, 100-year climate timescales. Sure, you can always find, there's a trend in droughts in Western California from 1995 to, bullshit, that's not climate. There's a fire, bullshit. You can't find these little areas, a little tiny region, and then draw a trend on some cherry-picked timeline and say, oh, look, the weather's getting worse. It's due to our SUVs. Bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. And then you have this lady, talking about the adult sleepwalking in her life and the little incremental change. She wants radical change. You know, she's just she is a avant-garde. She's a rebel who's fed all the bullshit of the United Nations and all the climate activists and academia, all the ruling class. And they think they're like, they've been fed all the same crap and they've swallowed it all hook, line, and sinker. And they think they're like counterculture. I'm going to go against the man. No, the man has programmed you. You're an effing robot at this point, just spewing bullshit from the UN and Bill Gates and the World Health Organization and all the climate activists who walk before you. You're not doing no critical thinking. I hope the adults aren't sleepwalking through your life. I hope they wake you up. All right. That's all I have to say about her. All right. This is clip three. Activist Benji Backer. ACC is the name of his organization, something climate, not climate. Anyway, he is a conservative, so-called, he claims to be conservative Republican climate activist. What? We've talked about Kevin McCarthy, the old House Speaker, who said, climate's a problem. Republicans believe in solutions. We're going to plant trees and we're going to capture carbon and we're going to pay our campaign donors billions of dollars to capture carbon and all these big boondoggles because we care about climate. We want solutions too, but the Green New Deal went a little too far. Let's do a Green New Deal light. Well, this is Benji Backer. Now, he's got a lot of good things to say. He says we need to change the narrative on climate change. Forget that phrase. He does say a lot of good things. I don't even know if I have it in this clip. I have three clips of him. I have a whole bunch of clips on him. This is him on The View. Now, you think, oh my gosh, a conservative Republican got on The View. How did that happen? Well, he's interviewed by Elisa Ferrer. Elisa Ferrer is the Trump administration communication person who turned against Trump and was not really conservative. She's conservative in the way Mitt Romney and John McCain are conservatives, okay? If you're pure GOP establishment, you're going to love Elisa Ferrer's views. And that's why she was acceptable to ABC News. She's very just weak, you know, a couple times she hit some good points, but most of the time she's there. I know her dad, Joe Ferrer. He founded WorldNet Daily. Just saw her dad, I think it was at CPAC or maybe the Heritage Foundation. He said, oh, I love your work, follow work. She's had major issues. She's publicly talked about, I guess, like, you have problems with her home life because her family disagrees with her politics. She's still a Republican, but she's not. Anyway, she chose Benji Backer, calls him his friend. He's making a lot of good points. That he's saying that we need to embrace environmentalism in the old school term. We need to embrace environmental issues. But where I lose him is when he crosses over and turns it into like climate change is part of the environment. If anything, no, I've interviewed scientists. Dennis Rancourt has been a guest on the show. Climate change has hijacked the entire environmental movement. Real environmental problems like the East Palestine toxic waste, they get thrown to the wayside because of the hijacking of climate and the virtue signaling. Anyway, here's Benji Backer, clip three. This is part one of him on The View. This is the only climate activist, a Republican climate activist, The View will allow. Someone who's all in on climate's a problem and we need a solution. Clip three.
It showed me that things aren't as black and white on this issue as what our current political narrative says. Our current political narrative says you either have to believe that the world's going to end tomorrow or that we should do nothing about environmental challenges whatsoever. And as a conservative activist throughout middle school, high school, and college, which was very weird at the time, I decided that my other love of the environment wasn't matching up and patching together with my conservative beliefs. Mm-hmm. So I started this organization called the American Conservation Coalition, and this book has the goal of changing for once and for all the narrative that this issue is partisan and getting conservatives back to the table.
Well, and I feel like there's a generational divide on this issue as well, because totally. You and I are both passionate about it as Republicans. And you've spoken at CPAC, but you've also mm-hmm. testified before Congress alongside Greta Thunberg and other prominent climate change activists. And your organization has been behind some very important legislation on Capitol Hill. But I think you talk about having encountered some hurdles with the older generation mm-hmm. being resistant to addressing this issue. How do you tackle that, and why do you think our generation may see it differently?
Well, we grew up in a time where we were learning about environmental degradation throughout all school, right? We learned about it in elementary school onward, and then it's also been all over social media, the effects of climate change.
Well, there you have it. Old people don't know because they weren't indoctrinated in school and they're not on social media. It's all over social media. So, of course, we're climate activists. We've been programmed to be so. Why aren't those old people with us? Oh, they haven't been exposed to all that font of knowledge that we get, all the consensus bullshit and all the climate stuff. Ugh. And again, he's right on one point, though. I want to give him credit because Republicans should talk about environmental issues. We can win on those. Since the first Earth Day, we've been able to radically clean up our air and water. We have technological innovations to save species. We have new ways of forestry. You can have tropical rainforest. You can't distinguish between a logged tropical forest in 5 to 7 years between an unlogged, and plant animal species are almost identical. We've come a long way. We have environmental success stories. We should be bragging. We should be dealing with environmental issues. What's left? Lead in the drinking water. And of course, things like the toxic waste dumps and other things. But the idea that climate is one of those, and we know that because we went to school. No, the older people are wiser. He should listen to them. There's a reason older people, the older you are, the more skeptical you are, because you've heard it all and you've rejected all. Okay, part two. This is Benji Backer on The View. This is clip four. Why kids believe in the climate scare. Clip four.
And the older generation, so I went to an event, a conservative event with all older people in Washington State, and I asked who here considers themselves an environmentalist today. Not a single hand, rose. But I said, who here considered themselves an environmentalist in the 1980s or 90s? Every single hand went up. And so the question then is, okay, so then why were they environmentalists in the 1980s and 90s, and they're now denying climate change and are skeptical of it? And it's not because they hate the environment. It's because they're scared of solutions hurting their communities. Mm. And I went to Midland, Texas, the heart of America's oil and gas country. And these people care a lot about the environment. They love hunting. They love fishing. They love being outdoors. They just feel attacked and vilified by our liberal leaders that are telling them that they're the enemy and that they're ruining our planet because of climate change, while they've spent their decades working really hard to power our lives. And they're scared that the solutions that are being proposed are going to come and take their livelihoods from them. Mm. And so we have an obligation to reach out to those communities and actually bring them into the conversation, because we all share this planet in a way that is undeniable. And those sorts of people who are older have become skeptical, not because they don't care, but because they see it as a liberal issue with liberal solutions that are going to hurt them.
And Benji is 100% correct. That's a great analysis he just gave. Of course, the only difference I would have is you don't try to bring them in and say, oh, no, climate's a problem, but we have better solutions than the Democrats. Climate's not a problem, and nothing we're going to be able to do is going to be able to solve it. And if you are worried about unmitigated CO2, you would just allow it to continue what the United States has been doing, which is being record reducing a CO2 through new technologies like hydraulic fracking. And we've led the world, especially when Donald Trump was president, in the highest reductions of CO2. So that's the kind of success stories you would want to tout if you were worried about it. And he's dead on, right? That's exactly the reason people are innately skeptical, because they see it as a socialist plot. And it generally is that, a central planning plot. He's trying to put a good face on it. And I'm sorry, he doesn't really offer that much compelling alternative. This is clip five on what Benji Backer's solutions would be. Clip five on The View.
Well, and I say this a lot on any major policy issue. The ones that have the most lasting effect are ones that are done on a bipartisan basis. So as you mentioned, we have the issue of denialism on the right, and then at times alarmism on the left. What do you see as some of the solutions that potentially both sides could get together on?
Well, I think a great example of this is I toured a coal mine in Utah that had a coal facility that was turning into a nuclear reactor and renewable hub. And so these people can keep their jobs in their local communities while also powering a clean energy future. And I think we have to be really open-minded about what energy sources we use and bring all those people in. So I think the solution that a lot of people can get behind is in any of the above energy solution is what I call it. Any cleaner energy source in our future should be on the table. And that means cleaning up natural gas. That means cleaning up coal. That means cleaning up oil. That also means more renewables and more nuclear and more geothermal. We have to be really open-minded, because if we are, we can bring in all the different parts of this country. And another good example of an area of overlap is sustainable agriculture, because you're pairing this belief in a pro-climate future while also equipping farmers to do things more sustainably so that they can actually get more money for a crop yield.
All right. There he's talking about nuclear and like coal workers. I mean, nuclear is very hard. I give him credit, though. He's pushing nuclear. That's good. It's not really much of a solution. That's a small anecdotal story. That's not really big picture. And in terms of farmers needing to be lectured on how they can be more earth friendly and climate sustainable and increase their crop yields by doing so, I'm sorry. I don't see that. I mean, farmers don't need the meddling and interference of climate activists, unelected bureaucrats to increase their crop yields. Benji Backer, the other thing he did was when he sat at Congress, this was 2019, the height of the Greta Thunberg moment, he sat on the same panel at a congressional hearing with Greta Thunberg. And what he did was praised Greta Thunberg and the other activists. One of them he praised was Jamie Margolis, Teen Vogue climate activist. She's the one who said when COVID lockdowns happened, if we can shut down the world for a virus, we can do the same thing for climate. These are the people Benji Backer praised. Here's Benji Backer praising Greta Thunberg, Julian Margolis, and a few other climate activists from the far left at a hearing as he touts himself as a conservative. Clip six.
And I would like to thank Chairman Keating, Ranking Member Kinzinger, Chairman Castor, and Ranking Member Graves for holding this very important hearing. I'm also honored to share this panel with Greta, Vic, and Jamie. Each of you have played a critical role in generating worldwide awareness around this issue of climate change, so thank you.
Yes, Greta Thunberg, thank you so much for your activism. You've raised awareness. Like, kids didn't have enough awareness. And the reason Greta Thunberg got involved is because she believed in the doomsday rhetoric she was being propagandized with. The reason all these kids are suing the EPA and Joe Biden and governments and states and the European Union is because they want governments to ensure their climate future. Anyway, I debated Benji Backer in 2021 at Freedom Fest in South Dakota. And this is clip seven, me bringing up this very point with Benji Backer on the stage. Clip seven, me debating him, bringing up the fact that he praised Greta Thunberg.
The biggest thing is, and I guess my biggest concern was Benji sat beside Greta Thunberg at a congressional hearing in 2019, turned to Greta and thanked her for raising awareness of the climate issue for young people across the world. To me, that was horrific. Greta Thunberg has done more to instill alarm in young people in unscientific nonsense than any person on the world. She shouldn't be thanked. She should be challenged. Thank you.
That was my debate with him, and the audience went crazy with that because he's very good. And again, I agree. We had long talks after this. I agree with probably 50% of his messaging and I haven't seen his new book. I've invited him on this program. I don't think he'll come, probably because of the clip I just showed you. I hope he comes. I'd be very nice to him. I'm not interested in attacking or debating anyone, really. I'd actually have him. I mean, I'm not going to be unfriendly about it. I'd like him to come on. I think we agree on at least half of his points, maybe 70%. Where we disagree is he conflates climate with environmentalism, number one. Number two, he believes just because young people all believe in climate change, that Republicans should just accept that and pander to them and come up with climate solutions that are free market. No, I think you have to reject the narrative. If you want to know how Benji's vision works, we've already have a perfect model. Look at Europe. Look at England. They have a net zero report, 2019, called the UK Fires Report, which calls for shutting down airports, cutting massive meat consumption, regulating CO2 as asbestos, and a couple other things like that. I believe that was the one that said asbestos. And you had the House of Lords debating it. I read the transcripts of this. And of course, climate's a problem. Maybe this report goes a little too far. Holy shit. Bullshit. Anyway, you can see that. No, this has to be fought on the premise and fight. Even if you believe there's a climate crisis, government can't legislate us out of it. Okay? It's silliness. It's just embarrassing. I don't know who funds them. I'm not going to get into his motives. I think he's very sincere. So I'd love to have him on the program to talk about his new book. And I'd like to see a copy of his book. Again, I think I probably agree with him well over 50%, maybe 75%. But that 25% is a key difference in our views. And I'm worried that the Republican Party, that's their natural inclination, is to follow. When I was in the U.S. Senate, you know, me and the Senator Inhofe were like the actual climate deniers, the skeptics. We didn't buy any of this crap. So many of the other offices, conservative Republicans were like, well, we have to be careful. Obama's cap and trade, we can't go against it on the climate change science because we don't want to be seen against the earth or against the environment. And they were all timid and afraid. And they'd all, of course, climate's a problem, but maybe this goes too far. Or maybe this just costs too much. At some point, the American public, if no one's pushing back on this whole idea of the scientific consensus and there's a climate emergency, climate crisis, they're going to be like, well, we're Americans, we're can do. I don't care how much it costs. Let's fight the climate and let's pass this legislation no matter how much it costs. And that's the problem. You know, these are elected officials who have access to public hearings, to experts from around the world, and they just weren't calling them. Now, after Inhofe came Senator Vitter of Louisiana. He was phenomenal chairman as well. And then they got incredibly weaker. I don't even know who chairs that committee now, but Barrasso from Wyoming, you think, oh, Wyoming, yeah, not that great. He's good on energy issues, but never would challenge the narrative. All right. Well, anyway, we have to take a break. The Benji backer debate will continue, and that whole movement push to get the GOP to embrace climate change as a problem and will offer solutions. I don't think it's going to catch on. I think it's the momentum is the exact opposite direction. Of course, ABC News, The View, everyone's going to praise Benji and feature him and his views. I also debated at the Republican Club of New York City. I'm not exactly sure if that was the name, but New York City Republican Club invited me October of 2022 to a debate with a guy named Quinn, and I don't have it in my head. We debated for like an hour and a half, took Q&A from the audience, the other young Republican who believes we should have the solution. And most of those New York Republicans, they didn't actually take a vote of the room, but I'd say most of them disagreed with me and agreed with him. These were liberal New York City Republicans generally. I mean, not, I shouldn't say liberal, but center, Mitt Romney happy, John McCain happy, Republicans. They're not going to, you know, so they were generally on his side. So I had an uphill battle, got a little media coverage. I didn't consider it a debate. In fact, I announced ahead of time, I did not want to have a debate because I really wanted to have a discussion. This was more of a strategy session about where the political parties should go on these issues and how to frame them. But I can't say that I swayed the audience. They seem to be with the other one when I started, and they mostly still seem, there's a lot of vocal supporters for me in the audience. But anyway, it's a fun night. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that kind of debate. It's so rare nowadays. Since Donald Trump was elected, all debate has stopped. I used to go on CNN, MSNBC, ABC News, regularly debating main figures. Everything, it's all ended. It's just very hard to have debates anymore. It's sad and depressing. Anyway, all right. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. When we come back, I believe she is going to be ready, but we have Diana Furchtgott-Roth, who is the Director of the Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment at the Heritage Foundation and Center of Energy and Environmental Policy with the Heritage Foundation. We'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
TNT's Rick Munn.
People are, terrified. What happens if the internet goes down? What happens if we can't get online? What happens if this? Listen, we've been around for millennia with no mobile phones. There's been revolutions in the past with no mobile phones. Wars have been won in the past with no mobile phones, okay? So we use them. Don't let them use you, but don't worry too much about it if things get shut down, because we've always got people, real physical people, inhabiting a real physical world there. So that's a little timely reminder of that.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk TNT.
Sometimes, a car comes along that changes everything. With innovations never thought possible, and features that make you wonder, how did people survive without this? This is that time, and this is that car. This is the world's first VWB. Equipped with transparent doors to eliminate reasonable suspicion, whatever that means. A 10-2 steering wheel that keeps hands visible at all times. We remove the glove box so there's no confusion about what the driver is reaching for. With a touch of a button, the ultrasonic biometric scanner displays the license and registration of the driver to ensure contactless exchange of information. With no trunk, nothing can be concealed, so therefore, there is nothing to search and seize. To ensure you will never be mistaken for breaking the speed limit, we've installed limited edition airless tires. And we removed the engine because, honestly, why risk it? DWB, the first vehicle of its kind, where the safety feature is the car itself.
I have a feeling these are the suspects in question. The two occupants look like the people involved in the armed robbery. I'm approaching the vehicle. Request backup. The driver matches the description because of a wide-set nose.
The human mind is like a computer. No matter how efficient it may be, its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano and TNT. All right, well, joining the program now is Diana Furthcott-Roth of the Heritage Foundation. She's the director for the Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment. And she's also former Deputy Assistant Secretary for the U.S. Department of Transportation under President Trump. She also worked in the U.S. Department of Treasury. She also worked under the Reagan, Bush, and Bush 41 and Bush 43. So a wealth of experience, Oxford-educated economist. Welcome to the program, Diana.
Great to be with you, Mark.
All right, and how do you say your last name? I don't want to butcher that. It's Furthcott-Roth.
Oh, you should just say Diana, but it's Furthcott-Roth.
Furthcott-Roth. All right, I was very close. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you for joining the program. All right, well, so you worked in Donald Trump's transportation department. How was that? What kind of issues did you work with? And can you attest firsthand to how the career staff treat the Trump appointees different? I know the EPA had a lot of problems with that, where they just wouldn't cooperate with what the Trump appointees wanted to do. It was sort of like a bureaucratic protest of some sort. Did you tell us about your experience? Was there any sort of thing like that? And what did you do for the Trump administration?
So I was in charge of research and technology. Congress allocates a budget of $1 billion a year, Mark. That's B for billion, not yes. million. $1 billion a year of research funds. And my job was to make sure it was spent appropriately, that the different sections of the transportation department, the highways, the highway safety, trucking, maritime, that they didn't duplicate research and that the research was finished on time. And transportation has a great staff, great career staff. We all got on very well. And what they do is they pivot from one administration's initiatives to another. So under Secretary Chao, the initiatives were innovation, infrastructure, and safety. And so what we tried to do was make sure that the research was going along smoothly and that the three top priority items were fulfilled.
Well, now, when you during the Trump administration, was there any glint? Did you have any hint that within a few years, the same department you worked at would be pushing things like gas-powered car bans or anything like that? Did you come across any of the either think tanks or activists or people in the bureaucracy who were like, hey, you know, the gas-powered, we're going to be banning gas-powered cars or proposals? Or did that come out of left field?
So the priorities for President Biden at the Transportation Department are electrification, climate yes. change, social justice. So the career staff very professionally pivoted to doing what those new politicals wanted to do. For example, we had people who worked in New York City who came to us, representatives of the transportation departments in New York, who came to us wanting to impose a congestion charge in New York. And we asked them for additional data. We did not approve this. And we asked them about, for example, parking above the congestion zone. In other words, if you're going to be charged $15, when you go from 61st Street in Manhattan to 60th Street, a lot of people are going to park their cars around 61st Street and then just walk over the line. So we asked all kinds of questions. We did not approve the congestion charge. But then these same people who were coming to us from New York were in power at the Transportation Department under President Biden. So, of course, they moved this through very speedily. And New Yorkers now have or will have in June a $15 congestion charge.
Wow, that's incredible. So it's when you keep you mentioned the professional staff. The professional staff, are they truly just professional then? And from what you've dealt with, I mean, they basically just do what the new administration wants, and there's never any sort of heel dragging or any kind of pushback from the right. From the permanent staff. That's amazing.
Yes, yeah, they are very, very professional. Plus, in my department, I had the Volpe Transportation Research Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Terrific research professionals looking at things like how you tell someone if someone is under the influence of marijuana when they're driving. This is an immense safety issue with more and more states making marijuana legal. Now, you can tell if someone's driving drunk because you can do a breath test or a blood test. Yeah. But with marijuana, it stays in your blood for weeks. So someone can say, well, yes, I was driving, there was marijuana in my blood, but it was because I smoked 2 weeks ago. And the incidence of accidents in these states that have legalized marijuana are really rising. There's 40,000 people killed on the roads every year, Mark, and we need to be doing something to reduce that. I mean, imagine if there were two plane crashes every week. People would say, we got to stop this. That would add up to a lot of people killed in the air. When there's one plane crash, we say we got to do something. But 40,000 people killed on the roads every year, people just, you know, they don't bat an eye. They just take it for granted, and it shouldn't be like that. So those are the kinds of things we were working on.
What is the solution for that? How do you test for marijuana? If it's still in your blood, is there a certain level, like blood alcohol level or, you know, THC level? What is the most efficient way to actually test if someone's driving under the influence of marijuana?
Well, they had not solved that problem by the time I left. So okay. I don't know if they've solved it now, but it's definitely not an easy thing to do.
Well, on that same vein, I know there's the, boy, I think it was a new, I want to say transportation bill, but there was something that passed Congress that had the, I guess it was onboard computer diagnostics that would taking breathalyzers. They're proposing potentially in the future to have breathalyzers in the car where it would monitor the driver's breath to see if you have too much blood alcohol level. Is that a reality or is that still science fiction?
I believe there are add-on gizmos that you can do, but what was proposed was to have the car stop if there was erratic driving behavior, the car be disabled. And here, this is really not a good idea because you could say swerve to avoid a pothole. You could be in a bad neighborhood right. And your car would suddenly stop. So we took a strong stand against that here at Heritage.
All right.
This was a, well, let's this go was back. A Biden era proposal.
Okay, it was. You were in Reagan, Bush, and Bush, I guess we'll say Bush 1 and Bush 2. Can you just tell us your background? What did you do for those administrations?
Well, I'm a professional economist by training, and I was a junior staff economist at the Council of Economic Advisors in the Reagan administration. And then in the George W. Bush administration, I was chief of staff of the Council of Economic Advisors. In the George H.W. Bush administration, I was with the Domestic Policy Council as deputy executive secretary, thinking up different kinds of domestic policy proposals.
Wow. Okay. So now you're at the Heritage Foundations, the director for Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment. So let's start there. Have you, and given all your experience going back to the 1980s in executive branch, have you ever seen an administration with any policy this ambitious when it comes to their climate agenda, to their energy agenda? I mean, they're coming after energy hard. They're coming after now, John Kerry says they're coming after agriculture. They're coming after high yield agriculture, nitrogen-based fertilizer. They're coming after methane, which then implies meat eating, rations. They're coming after the bans on gas-powered cars. They're trying to force EVs. In your experience, how ambitious are these Biden plans? Are they ambitious to the point where they're almost ridiculous, or are they actually achievable with a lot of pain? How would you characterize it?
I would describe it as basically not achievable, very harmful to the economy, and they would not help the environment. So even if we got rid of all the fossil fuels in the United States right now, it would only make a difference of 0.2 degrees centigrade by the year 2100. Western Europe, if they got rid of all their fossil fuels, it would make a difference of about 0.1 degrees centigrade. In other words, these do not help the climate. Why? Because Asia, China, India, Africa, Latin America, they're not signing onto the program. And when I point this out to people saying, well, it doesn't do any good for us to just move energy intensive manufacturing over to China where it's made in a dirtier manner, it doesn't reduce global emissions. The answer I get is, well, they'll just have to get with the program. Well, good luck with that. I mean, yeah, they're just not going to do it. So it doesn't help at all. If we really wanted to reduce global emissions, if we thought this was a problem, we should be exporting more liquid natural gas, more nuclear power technology, so we can have energy-dense production with lower emissions. That's how the United States, over the past 16 years, has reduced carbon emissions by 1,000 million metric tons because of the switch to natural gas.
Yeah, let's talk about that. When Donald Trump, president, pulled us out of the UN Paris Agreement, I mean, temporarily, it was during a time, and I don't even know if it's still true today, but the United States was leading the world of reducing CO2 emissions. And we were being sort of finger wagged by all the European allies saying, oh, you guys are outlaws. You're not in the UN. But we were doing better than them if your goal was to reduce CO2 emissions. So explore that a little bit. How did that happen? How did that switch to natural gas? Because if I remember correctly, the International Energy Agency, I believe it was them, forecast from like 2008, 9, none of their predictions of U.S. emissions really forecast what happened with the fracking revolution. Can you walk us through a little bit just how the U.S. ended up leading the world in reducing CO2 emissions?
Well, first of all, these energy forecasters are not particularly good at predicting. No one predicted that we would have this wonderful technology and we would be able to be one of the world's leading natural gas exporters. So that's what's happened. What was a game changer was horizontal drilling, where instead of having to drill one hole down to get one well, you could put in a horizontal pipe and have vertical wells go down from there. And then hydrofracturing followed that. So you could have a horizontal pipe. You could have other pipes coming off that vertically. So with a very small footprint, you could be getting a lot of natural gas and a lot of oil. And what was really destructive was about a month ago, President Biden said he was going to pause our natural gas export terminals, meaning that we don't have a way to export all this natural gas we're producing to our allies. So they have to use more coal, more dirtier ways of running their electricity grids. And this is a benefit not just to the United States having all this natural gas, but it has geopolitical benefits too. So with Russia cutting off natural gas to Europe, America is able to step up and export more. And it's just really amazing that President Biden should, as he puts it, pause natural gas exports, new natural gas exports, but really it is banning new natural gas exports, because this benefits not only American producers, but it benefits also our allies.
Yeah, in fact, I remember specifically the Biden administration made pledges to many of the European allies when the invasion of Ukraine happened that they would help fill in the gap for energy lost by Russia and some of the other sanctions. And of course, that's got geopolitical impacts now that he's denying them that promise. He's falling back on the promises he made to our European allies. All right, we have to take a break. We're talking with Diana Furthgott-Roth, the director for Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment, former Trump administration officials. We'll continue this discussion. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We'll be right back.
When the world's endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. But the danger to animals the world over is growing, and the need for your help has never been more urgent. On land, you'll help stop poachers from threatening and killing elephants and big cats for the illegal wildlife trade. In the oceans, you'll help rescue dolphins, whales, and seals from deadly hazards. And you'll help rescue, rehabilitate, and release vulnerable animals when disasters strike. Here at home and around the world, we can't do this work without you. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifall.org.
Need a ride?
Yeah!
Driving with kids is a big responsibility.
Hop in and buckle up!
So don't sweat the small stuff.
You got paint all over our paper!
Get the big stuff right instead.
What does that mean?
Like making sure your kids are in the correct car seat and buckled up for safer travel.
That deserves a wiggly wiggly wig.
To make sure your child is in the right seat for their age and size, visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Beep, beep. Yeah.
This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed on TNT. We're talking with Diana Furthcott-Roth. She's the Director of Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment at the Heritage Foundation. And she's also a former Trump Transportation Administration official. I want to talk a little bit deeper into EVs here. Are you aware, is it possible that I missed it, but did anyone in the United States, any legislator or a Democratic body ever vote to ban gas-powered cars? It seems, in terms of authorizing it, I know the Republican Congress did a vote, but were there any state, I don't even believe the state of California voted to ban it. It was all done through executive orders, unelected bureaucrats, and now the Biden EPA is doing it. Is there any democracy involved? Maybe Europe? Did anyone ever vote to ban gas-powered cars?
In the United States, there's the EPA regulations, there's Transportation Department regulations, and then there's the California Air Resources Board. So they all got together and said that after a certain time, whether it's 2035, 2032, no gasoline-powered cars can be sold. In California, it's no gasoline-powered cars can be sold after 2035. With the EPA and Department of Transportation regulations, it's 70% of new cars sold have to be electric by 2032. And since it's so difficult to sell those cars, Mark, they price them artificially low, which means they price the cars that I like to buy artificially high. So we are paying for all those better off people who are buying their Teslas and Rivian trucks and whatever else it is.
I was going to play a clip. I wanted to play you Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen talking about how wonderful the Biden administration's EV transition is going. Can we play clip one, TNT? Let's play this for Diana. I want her to get her reaction to what Janet Yellen has to say about EVs.
This administration has placed a lot of emphasis on domestic production of electric vehicles, of batteries, but demand for electric cars is falling, or is falling off rather. And it does seem like this is the sort of product that may require sort of constant subsidies to prop up demand. You've talked a little bit about this, but let me push you somewhat to say, has this been a wrong bet by you and the president?
I think we're going to see a growing and thriving electric vehicle industry in the United States. We're already seeing that. I think the prospect for sales of EVs, especially as the charging network is built out nationally and the adjustments take place in the supply chain that enable car manufacturers to qualify for the there's a $7,500 tax incentive that's available for purchasers of these cars. We've issued notices of proposed rulemaking on how to qualify. It does require substantial shifts in the supply chain in particular, but we're seeing that occur. And electric battery production in the United States is just booming. I've been in Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, other places to see huge build out of electric batteries for EVs. And I think we're going to see swelling demand in the years ahead, and the incentives are all there.
All right. Sorry, that was a long clip. But basically, she's saying the swelling demand for EVs is there. She toured a battery plant and saw all these batteries. She's impressed. We have tax credits. And yeah, there's some supply chain adjustments. But she's very optimistic. Like, this is about to happen. We're about to, the people are just going to be clamoring for EVs. Is that reality?
It's not reality. And it's interesting that the three states she mentions are right-to-work states rather than the unionized states.
Yes.
So that's also interesting. No, Americans are not buying these EVs as a forecast. With the tax credits for the manufacturers, for their electric vehicle plants, for the battery plants, tax credits for consumers to buy them, it's still only around 7 or 8% of vehicle sales. And there are very good reasons for that. First of all, they cost more. Second, they're inconvenient. You don't want to have to stop and recharge for a couple of hours when you're on a long trip. And third, it means we're dependent on China. We're never going to be able to make those batteries and components as cheap as China does. And we are going to be dependent on them for this equipment as long as we mandate these electric vehicles. Now, Americans mostly want to buy a car with some internal combustion engine. It's interesting that the non-plug-in hybrids, for which there is no tax credit, are flying off the dealer's lots. That's when you have a larger battery, which is charged with the operation of the engine or the braking system, meaning you can get about 40 or 50 miles to the gallon. So these are very popular. But Americans, quite rightly, do not want to be tied to a charging station. I mean, imagine if I told you, Mark, you can get an electric car and you can go wherever the government puts its charging stations. I mean, what would you say to me? Stephen Weston, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you.
Yes, yeah. And they've had some problems, right? I think they've only built less than 10 or so, right, from all that funding so far. I can't remember how many. The number has changed a little bit.
Well, we have a vast country. And for Americans, driving and driving inexpensively is a birthright. No one wants to be told you have to buy this expensive vehicle and you can only go where the charging stations are.
Yeah, is a federal charging station a good idea? I mean, when you think about it, the Model T, when Henry Ford had that, and gas stations sprung up all over America as average Americans could afford it. There was no national centralized coordination of those mom and pop gas stations, right? What are the problems with having a national charging grid? And by the way, let me ask you this. Does that mean that during the next COVID-style pandemic, they can just, instead of issuing stay-at-home orders, they can just shut off the national charging grid once everyone's an electric car? Is that the kind of control they can have with that? Is there a danger to this national charging grid?
Well, I think we all know that when you put something in the hands of government, it doesn't do as well as when a private company does. And about 2/3 of these electric vehicles sold are Teslas. And Tesla has put a charging network for its customers, and they are very happy with it. And people who buy Teslas, they know that they can charge up, rely on the Tesla network. The government network is a little slow to roll out, and then people are not sure if the charging stations always work. We saw in Illinois last winter that they all froze up because of the low temperatures. And cold is another reason a lot of people don't like to buy electric vehicles. They lose 20 to 40% of their battery range in the cold. And they just don't operate reliably in states like Wyoming, Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota. It's not a practical alternative for a family who needs a car to work all the time. Now, if you have one car just to go to work and you can come back and charge it in a garage, and then you can take another car with an internal combustion engine on a long trip, then that's fine. And these are the kind of people who are buying these electric vehicles. They generally have two cars. The EV is a second car. And I'm all in favor of anyone who wants an EV to be able to buy one. I just think they shouldn't force us to buy them.
Yeah, if they're so great, why do they have to ban their competition? That's the question. Right. And the other thing with EVs, is you do you wish that the automakers had pushed back harder early on? It seemed like they were very willing, or maybe they were blackmailed or threatened. Why did they go along with this? Now, of course, they're pushing back, everyone from Toyota to Chrysler. And you had the Hertz CEO, I believe it was Hertz, not Avis, the rental car CEO was forced to resign because he went all in. And of course, the customers of Hertz rental car rejected EVs because of lack of consumer demand and high maintenance costs. That's pretty much a killer in the auto industry. Why didn't the auto industry push back harder against the Biden EV mandates?
Well, the auto industry, those companies are afraid of their regulators. They've signed up to the California mandate. They've said, even if the California waiver, the rule that allows California to set standards, is overturned, they are still going to go all electric in 2035. And Mark, you say they're fighting back, but they are not suing the government about this EV rule that just passed EPA. So I wouldn't say they're fighting back at all. I say they're giving in to the regulator, and they should be fighting back. They should be back because they should be standing up for their customers who want to buy the cars that they are buying right now.
Good point. I stand corrected on that. I should have said they're rhetorically pushing back a little bit because I've heard some comments. All right, we only have about 25 seconds left. Joe Biden thinking of declaring a national climate emergency. Center for Biological Diversity says it would give him 130 wartime-like powers. NBC News says it will give them 9/11 COVID-type emergency powers. What are your thoughts? Should Joe Biden declare a national climate emergency? About 15 seconds to answer.
Well, he should not. But if he does, and he does all these things that take away people's cars and raise their electricity bills and send jobs offshore, it's not going to help him politically. He should roll back his green agenda. That will help him get elected.
All right. Thank you very much. Diana Firthgott-Roth, Heritage Foundation Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment. Thanks for joining the program today.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. See you next time.